You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
This is the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is the 17th of September, 2025, and thank God this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I couldn't decide what to do today. I have so much material. You know, I work 24 hours a day. You know, this is completely a full-time job, thanks to many of my donors, but I landed on something. I discovered an author, or rediscovered an author, named Hua Bin. Now, I couldn't find a whole lot about him. I think he means that on purpose. He does it on purpose. I don't think that's even his full name. All I could find out is that he was a Chinese businessman and an observer of geopolitical events. And his English, of course, is excellent. Otherwise, I could find very little about him out there. But reading his stuff, I found something by accident. He's very profound. Now, as I have my Ukraine war book coming out very soon. The China book I have has been postponed. The Peter the Great book has been postponed. And so, you know, this, if you guys only knew the amount of work and revisionism that I deal with here. But his profundity comes from a strictly Chinese nationalist point of view. And I've done this before. The lies about China have been completely outrageous over the years. And as I always do, I always mix my own, you know, I paraphrase some of these guys and mix my own attitudes within them. And I found something that he did right after the Charlie Kirk murder. I have to admit something to you. I barely knew anything about him. I knew of his existence. I knew the meme, some guy with the prove me wrong thing. The Charlie Kirk, he never really crossed my radar very much. And there's good reason for that. Now, to the extent he may bring people into some kind of a revisionist mentality at some point. You know, when I was in college, I was, you know, my freshman, sophomore year, I was a typical human events style conservative, you know. If he's your first step, then that's a good thing. But political assassinations, that's pretty normal in the U.S. But the targets usually are of far more significant people, right? People like, you know, Robert Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump. And I am shocked by the firestorm of media. This man didn't hold any office. He wasn't a member of the ruling class whatsoever. I guess in human events style conservatism, he was quite influential. And in that youth movement, which is always very important. But I always found him, what little I heard of him, very unremarkable. And my biggest problems with the Trump administration has been on China policy, I've been to Trump rallies, and I've heard him say, not Charlie, I'm talking about Donald himself, say that China has stolen jobs from the U.S. This is absolutely, you know, like they invaded America, broke down a factory and brought it back to China. And you have to have zero critical thinking faculties to believe that. And Charlie Kirk, you know, repeated that. Now, in the 1970s, China was still a closed, planned economy. Didn't have a whole lot of interaction with the West. A bit later, during the Reagan administration, American businesses began to offshore. As companies moved to low-cost production centers to reduce labor costs, but not and prices would remain the same, so they would increase profit. So, America's deindustrialization is and the rule of the financial oligarchy, rather than the industrial elite, has been a disaster. Well, it's a frying pan fire, really. But the deindustrialization happened well before China's entry into the WTO in 2001. So the cause of this deindustrialization, it's not just China, but, you know, it's India and Philippines, it has nothing to do with the Chinese government or the Indian government. It's the drive for profit maximization by the owners of these firms. With or without China, U.S. businesses would have pursued the same strategy. I did hear him say something else, which I haven't heard very often. Maybe I haven't heard it at all. But he said someplace that China's success is based on the U.S. allowing it into the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Apparently, he regurgitated that often. Well, China joined the WTO in 2001, as I mentioned. Most of your standard countries were already in it. And none of them had an economic takeoff like China. India joined the WTO in 1995. Still then, has a GDP less than 20% of China. And per capita GDP lower than Bangladesh. So membership in the WTO doesn't guarantee anything. And he says, you know, same as sending a team to the Olympics doesn't mean you're going to win any medals, which is something that India knows very well. So he doesn't seem to have any great insight into this. The claim, of course, as you've all heard 100 times, is economic engagement with China has something to do with democratic rule, showing how much better the Americans live. Well, that may have worked in the 60s. But not anymore. If you believe it today, that's simply a lie. It's a projection, or really a deflection. The only thing that really mattered in these cases was the profit motive. Promoting freedom, of course, is, you know, every American foreign policy engagement, no matter how stupid, has that attached to it. So the logic goes like this. As China gets wealthier from trade with the Americans, the Chinese would want more of American freedom and thus change its social system to be like the U.S. Now, I'm not so sure anyone wants a government like the U.S., but it's very self-serving. The 1970s, Nixon and Kissinger opened up China, as the cliche goes, with one of the most evil men on the planet, Mao Zedong, also had a nuclear weapon by that point. That was hurt fine by them, I guess. Even communist Vietnam was they tried to get them into this, to encircle China later. But I really think that Kirk was sincere in this regard. Then there's, and I've heard this, and this is like your human events style, or actually even more, you know, National Review. If you buy Chinese goods, you fund the Chinese military, which makes me laugh, because I don't know how you can avoid it. Although the U.S. is not a major market for the Chinese anymore. We'll get to that here in a minute. But of course, you know, the reverse is always true. The Chinese would be arming the U.S. military if they drink Coke or use an iPhone or drive Tesla or whatever. You know, unfortunately, Charlie Kirk, poor guy, was very poorly educated. He was very earnest. He was ill-informed. He was very average. Which, of course, begs the question. And he lived within a Republican misinformation regime. Maybe as the years went on, he changed a little bit. I mean, he promoted the Gaza genocide for a while, but I don't really know this, but I'm told that recently he was starting to turn on that. I'm still quite mystified, though, as to the media outpouring. Right-wingers get shot all the time. In Germany, I know, I think some of you may have read, 7 of the nationalist German party there, 7 candidates, have either been killed or disappeared recently. But, you know, Kirk actually compares quite well with, when you consider who Trump has brought into the government. Right? Like Hegseth, who couldn't name a single member of ASEAN. You know, Rubio, who just was straight neocon without a single original idea. Patel, the FBI director, who, first of all, is going to abolish his own office and disclose the Epstein files at some time. One of my favorites is Linda McMahon, Secretary of Education. I didn't know that this was, I had to look it up, that she referred to AI as A1, like the steak sauce. And it's true. I thought it was just the left making something up, but it's true. Brooke Rollins, she wanted us to raise chickens to deal with the egg shortage, which I have not experienced. And Kristi Noem, the former beauty pageant queen who was Secretary of Homeland Security, who actually stated that China has a 2,000-year plan to destroy the U.S. 2,000 years. So Kirk, it looks pretty good compared to these people. So when I'm talking about ignorance, you know, constructing your opponent rather than understanding it, this is what I'm talking about. You don't find this mentality in the East. Now, as far as the Chinese are concerned, the Chinese are mentally better off than the West in terms of things like depression and suicide and the rest. Well, anyone's better off than the West. Happiness, basic contentment with their government is far higher than in the U.S. So anything the West says about, like, Xi Jinping is pretty meaningless. But policymakers don't know much about the country. Johnson's Law really matters here. Let me talk about Xi Jinping, and this is what I just found in Hao Bian's writings that struck me. Last 12 years, he wrote this late last year. And why she should be very, very respected. Something that, things that could never happen in the West. And it's true that in 2013, there was a wave of corruption at all levels. Citizens called it the number one issue facing the country. She has run the longest anti-corruption campaign in Chinese history, which is saying something. In his first 5 years, over 1 million officials from national, local government, state-owned companies, privately-owned companies, banks, military, have been prosecuted and punished for taking bribes at various levels. This is not a purge. This is simply a anti-corruption drive. This included over 300 vice minister level and above officials out of roughly 2,000 in total. One member of the Politburo, the standing committee anyway, two vice chairmen of the Central Military Commission, seven cabinet ministers, including really the tragic one, the railway minister, Liu Jian, who was sentenced to death. He had it suspended really to 16 years because he was head of the railway department, and there was a massive collision which was traced very easily. The Lunzhou train collision of 2011, that was traced very easily to not only his corruption, but those around him, including hiring incompetence, kickbacks, you know, cutting corners, that sort of thing. And it continues to this day. You have CEOs, senior bankers, hospital administrators have been removed for corruption with evidence. This is one of the reasons why foreign polls have shown Chinese to have changed completely. These people were notorious. The Chinese population, at least the Han population, have a very high level of satisfaction over government work in the last decade, let alone with the poverty reduction and the Common Prosperity Project. Between 2010s, roughly, you started to have an American-style, you know, income disparity, and resentment started to grow. And it's going to happen when you have a racially homogenous population. And so he announced the Common Prosperity and Poverty Reduction Initiative. And it's very interesting. It's 3 million officials, volunteers, were sent to rural areas to live and work on the site for targeted poverty alleviation for 3 years. This apparently was a huge success. Almost $200 billion worth was invested. This is what brought 100 million people out of extreme poverty. And at the same time, it's these people, these volunteers, is now the new basis of the party's rule. They have firsthand experience in rural management, a potential future pool of merit-based promotions. So many purposes were achieved here. That is not possible in the Western world, given the fact that it's an oligarchy. There's been a pay reduction in bureaucracies and financial service industry. China is probably the only country in the world where bankers are now being paid less than they were 10 years ago. And part of that was to show the world that, you know, engineers are far more important than middlemen. Financiers may have a role, sort of, but people who actually make things and theorize about making things are far more important. And of course, the Belt and Road. We've talked about that on this show 1,000 times. I want to talk about a massive success. This is what causes the Western hatred against China, among other things. But this is a huge one. 149 countries have signed up. This comes straight out of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I think one of the more recent examples that he mentions is the 1.5 billion port in container point in Peru, which has remade Peru's trade growth and China's access to South American raw materials, which has infuriated the U.S. Chinese have built bridges, ports, railroads, tunnels, hospitals, without the same ideological demands or political demands that the West has done when it's attempted to do this. And only does it if there's an immediate profit motive. Well, there's not really an immediate profit motive to do these things, so it doesn't get done. China has made far better use of its vast production capacity and diversified its trade relationship away from the collective West, which hates it. So China is no longer dependent on the West, whether the EU or the US. And up until a few years ago, I still thought, well, you know, the American market is the one weapon that the Americans had against the Chinese. Well, that's not true, and it isn't true anymore. Remember that Build Back Better nonsense? God knows where all that money went. That was an attempt to imitate that when the people who controlled Biden were installed into office. They were supposed to invest trillions. And I don't know of anything that has come out of that. There's also a Made in China 2025 initiative, which I never thought was a huge problem for them. Made in America is a huge problem for the Americans, but there's been a constant growth in the global supply chain in China from low-end manufacturing to high-end, high-value-added manufacturing, from telecom to automotive to aerospace, pharmaceuticals, whatever, even green tech. And because you have a state controlled but not state-owned system, which is largely run at a local level, by the way, it can focus on what it does best. In the 2015 blueprint, China has now achieved roughly 90% of its stated goals. China leads the world by a wide margin in electric vehicles, solar, wind, renewable energy, drones, battery technologies, all sectors. Science and technology, the Chinese have gone far beyond the West. And one of the sources for this is the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Normally, they're very critical of the Chinese. They have their technology tracker. And China leads in 57 out of 64 fields that have been identified as critical technologies for the future. Now, I have no faith in these technologies. But as far as a common citizen is concerned, this is important to them. Things like telecom, semiconductors, you know. These things, I think, are a double-edged sword, at least. But my point is, the Americans can't point to themselves anymore. They are not the originators. They are not the domination, the dominators of any kind of industrial innovation. It's really a monopoly situation here. China had suffered the worst pollution problem, I think, in the planet, as the industrialization program had just exploded the last three decades. You know, there was that famous, I don't know if you've seen The Onion, a video from years ago of the Chinese ambassador who thought that the UN said China is the greatest polluter on the planet, and the Chinese took that as a huge compliment, not realizing that it was meant to, you know, attack them. And he said, "Our skies are a rainbow, reflecting all the shades of our prosperity." From The Onion. But that's not the case anymore. There's a massive green drive, and probably the largest on the planet. Because China does have the state has taken advantage there too. Reforestation. We know what Mao did. Mao completely deforested the entire country. Water, soil improvement, reclamation of arid land, land use reform. China plants more trees in a year than the rest of the world put together. China has built a 3,000-mile green belt around the world's second-largest shifting sand desert, the Taklamakan Desert. And locally, electric vehicles, for whatever they're worth, I've done very well there. In China, it's 50% of all global sales. China now has some of the lowest pollution levels in Asia. The only time you had a problem was sandstorms from the desert areas. And especially when you consider what's going on in India, they call it the air apocalypse, severe air pollution. And because now China is, as we know, is 95% roughly Han Chinese, because of that racial and linguistic and ethnic uniformity, China has a very low crime rate. China has very low drug use rate and homeless rate. And that's the same. That's the case anytime you get a country that has a that is similar. Same thing for the army. Two vice chairmen, the Central Military Commission, were arrested for corruption in Xi's first 6 months, maybe a year. Two defense ministers were arrested in the last 12 months for corruption. People who were well known for that sort of thing. Huge investments have now been made in new weapon system development. We all know the U.S. could rattle its sword against China no matter what. China can't be beaten, not in its own backyard, not in anyone's backyard. China leads the world in hypersonic and unmanned systems. China now has so many hypersonic missile attack systems against U.S. aircraft carrier groups that I don't even remember them all. DF-17, 21, DF-26, DF-27, YJ-21. And they're all meant as carrier killers at hypersonic speeds, so they can't be defended against. Some of them are hypersonic glide vehicles, making the only thing that the U.S. could really be proud of, it's aircraft carrier dominance, pretty much irrelevant. Not to mention the Chinese don't have an empire that spans the entire planet to pay for. Now, the Chinese have cracked down on tech monopolies in a way that the American government never could. Like Alibaba, Tencent. Now, the reality is that these consumer companies in China were becoming rent-seeking monopolies, just like their counterparts in the U.S. This is why the state is so important in these things. I don't care what the libertarians say. Because you started having monopoly capital in places like Alipay, institutions like that. But the same thing with Google and Facebook. But there's no political will, not to mention regulatory capture. Fact is that the U.S. was chagrined when it lost its fight against Microsoft in 1997, if you remember. That actually, that battle had a huge impact on me as a student, a grad student. Fact is that Microsoft was more powerful than the Justice Department in an antitrust, anti-monopoly case. And that stuck with me. And I started to realize, wait a minute, the entire model now is oligarchic. It has nothing to do with markets. People talk to you about housing speculation. There was a problem of industrial property. Maybe a quarter of China's GDP, housing prices became rampantly speculative. That is, you know, bought and sold for a profit. And so it created a bubble beyond the purchasing power of the average citizen. And they absorbed the majority of the banking loans and people's savings. These are some of the corruption issues that led some of these people to go to prison. People got evicted over this stuff. Chinese government was not going to allow a housing bubble. And his famous slogan was, houses are for people to live in, not for profit. Which seems very trite, but it actually is, you know, an entire policy. Now, when the bubble burst, it was nothing like it happened, what it was in the U.S. It didn't cause any systematic breakdown. You've heard me talk about that before. There was no banking crisis. How could there be? It's a state banking system. But that property bubble burst was an excellent thing. Housing became more affordable, and debts were reduced. Some debts were simply erased because the party could do that. A government can't do that in the U.S. A government can't say to a bank to write off a debt. No, I mean, it could absorb the debt, but it can't cancel it. You know, your typical economic textbook, you have this very, very immature distinction between state planning on the one side and the free market on the other. The West, you know, the Thatcher-Reagan style, neoliberalism was the market side, and the old Soviet Union was the state planning side. Now, who I've been quoting a little bit here, who was deep into the Chinese economy for years, he breaks the Chinese economic history in this era, maybe 70 years roughly, this way. From 1949 to 1978, the emulation of the Soviet, the Stalinist phase. And I think very little was accomplished. 30 million, 40 million Chinese were killed. The economy was ridiculously distorted. You did not have a strong industrial base. But then, when the party rested, when after Mao's death, and Mao's supporters were rounded up, which was a wonderful thing for the world, you did see a quick development of some kind of state-private capitalism, rapid economic growth, rising standard of living with a single party at the local level, but you have increasing wealth disparity, environmental in inflation, and a lot of this. But from 2012 on, you have a mixture of these things. State planning and market competition at really the local level for the most part. And I've said many times before that Western economists don't understand this. It doesn't fit into any of their models. You can't deny the Chinese success here. You know, what is state planning now as far as China is concerned? Well, you identify key industries to focus on that they know that they can do well on. They could set vague but concrete vague but tangible targets. I shouldn't say concrete. It has to be a certain amount of money and not ownership but control. You still have the China State Planning and Development Commission, and they assemble the best minds, and not just in government but academia, the think tanks, industries, and they go through research, studies, a survey. What could they do the best in? Future market demand and the rest. Nothing like this, of course, exists in the West, but it can exist in China because it's 95% Han Chinese. Now, once the state planning priorities are set, areas where they know that they can do well, central government empowers local governments to implement them. This is the huge thing that very few people understand. It's local governments, roughly the county level, even the urban level. And there's a lot of market competition, quite fierce. Local governments compete with each other. Each one has a tremendous incentive to create local tech and industrial champions. Career advancements are usually based on this, and you have to prove your worth. And so they start developing things like, you know, preferential taxes, land use, preferential bank loans, all of this. And then from that, the university system then responds by having educational programs based on those things, talent acquisition, the promotion of successful technical leaders and executives in critical industries into senior government positions at that point. And this is one of the reasons that they cracked down on Alibaba and Tencent in 2019, because there were monopolies. There was consuming too much financial talent resources, and they were preventing startups from emerging. So then these key technological industrial hubs across China, Shanghai, Shenzhen, Wuhan, Chengdu, Hefei, Changsha, all of these EV companies, solar energy, AI, whatever, shipbuilders, drone firms, all based on competition, not merely competition amongst companies, but ownership models as well. Private businesses, state-owned enterprises, foreign companies, all have to compete for customers on a price and quality and operate. Generally speaking, Chinese companies have a very thin profit margin. for that very reason. That's the foundation for Chinese success. And I don't think you could have a decentralized system like that unless you have a strong racial foundation. The West, on the other hand, of course, is an oligarchy. The state picks winners. The presidents surround themselves with senior executives of incumbent tech giants. They're surrounded by them when they have policies like the Inflation Reduction Act, which had nothing to do with inflation, Stargate program, whatever it is. It's to be expected. Almost by its very definition, the main beneficiaries of these policies will be the people in the room. China has far more of a market system in that regard than the West has. It's not just among firms, but ownership types, all within a single plan idea that the party runs, and a far broader, cultural revival that's going on there. The single biggest risk factor for China, say in the next 10 years, is not so much their economic performance, but their geopolitical competition. The U.S. still demands, somehow, the right to dictate what goes on in places like the South China Sea. I still find it hard to believe that the U.S. will be involved in a peer-to-peer war with China. It's very possible, but there is some precedent. Yeah, in fact, Hao uses this example. The Qing Dynasty in 1840. China had a GDP that was roughly 6 times that of Britain, 20 times that of the U.S. But the Jews and the Sassoon family and the East India Company were pumping up China with drugs on the basis of free trade. And hence the Opium Wars, where the Chinese lost. And the 100-year humiliation, as they call it, comes directly from that. But there's nothing in American rhetoric and behavior. I mean, it's extremely violent history. The U.S. has been very erratic. Even if it does arms proxies and creates terrorist acts, the point is to damage as much Chinese capital as possible. So if you are, you're Russia, you are Iran, the Chinese, Burma, whatever, you either living on your knees, serving the Western masters and seeing your country destroyed, or you fight. That's really what the SCO was all about. Whether the Chinese want it or not, things are coming down to some kind of a life or death fight. But it's a war that the U.S. can't win. As I mentioned before, China now leads in 57 out of 64 critical technologies for the future. And we're talking about military stuff here. The nuclear attack capability, this 11,000-mile hypersonic, these 15,000-mile goes Mach 25. China's fifth-generation stealth-heavy fighter, the J-20, with his new upgraded engine. It outperforms everything. Speed, maneuverability, stealth, avionics, radar, EW capability, speed, range, firepower, blows away the F-35. And the Chinese can make it cheaper. China produces maybe 100 J-20s a year. And if you listen to this show on a regular basis, you know how many failures, like the F-22, the Zumwalt, all these things, the U.S. attempts to keep up and it fails miserably, and billions are thrown out the window. Iran is a very high-tech, highly scientific country, and they're a critical link in this axis of resistance. Russia, Iran, China. The Oreshnik missile, which can't be defended against, still kind of experimental. But still, China's DF-17, DF-26, they're mature systems. U.S. Navy, as I've said, I don't know, 20 times before, openly comes out and, you know, openly acknowledges China's shipbuilding capacity is 230 times that of the U.S., and it's unlikely to change. It's still, the Navy's still outsourcing shipbuilding to Korea and India against its own laws. Because you have state-owned companies versus for-profit companies in the West, China's able to make these things. You know, they make, you know, precision-guided rockets, the same unit cost as U.S. builds, like, you know, dumb artillery ammo, like the 155-millimeter shell. The Pentagon head of procurement warned in 2023. He said that China's defense budget has a 3-to-1 advantage against the U.S. in procurement value for money. That's because China is an industrialized society. The U.S. is not. And the very poor performance of American weaponry in Ukraine has proved that. You're not even getting quality here. China has a PHL 16, the competitor to the HIMARS, but a far greater range, far greater satellite system. This is one of the reasons I just don't think the U.S. is going to take this on. So even if their GDP slows, you know, the Western analysts go crazy, well, that doesn't matter. The technological and military advancements like this, you see the same in Iran. You know, they absolutely dominate. Iran dominates in every competition in science and technology. Samuel Huntington once said, the West rules the world not because of the superiority of its values or ideas, but because of the superiority in organized violence. The West doesn't acknowledge it, but the rest of the world never forgets it. I know I've been going on about this for such a long time and for so many shows, but it is the key element. But let me end this in his argument. He wrote this on April 27th, 2025, for the total, complete decoupling between China and the U.S. His argument is that it's not sustainable, the current arrangement. The U.S. is going broke. I mean, it's gone beyond broke. It's hemorrhaging money. Still, the U.S. will never surrender its global hegemony. Really, unless it can find a way to save face, which is hard to do. And China's not going to back down. Why should it? Morality's on China's side. The U.S. has no business intervening with it. The situation's far from its shores. Time's also on China's side. The U.S. cannot handle a war of attrition, even a cold war of attrition. So what are these economic ties? Well, roughly 440 billion Chinese goods exported to the U.S. and something like 190 billion imported. So massive trade deficit constantly. 500 billion U.S. direct investment in China, and maybe 700 billion generated in the Chinese market. Most large U.S. companies have significant China domestic sales in every industry. You know, P&G, McDonald's, Coca-Cola. Boy, what would China do without McDonald's? You know. China is the second largest market after the U.S., and it's far more stable than the American one. Multinational corporations are dependent on Chinese supply lines, or I should say supply chains, for both sales in China and abroad. Amazon, Walmart, they source 60-70% of their merchandise from China. If something like 500,000 Chinese students going to study in the U.S. every year, $28 billion annual China direct investment in the U.S., like manufacturing, real estate, equity, whatever. But you don't have a lot of Chinese brands counting the U.S. as a large market. None of them the top 100 Chinese companies, you know, PetroChina, Alibaba, Huawei, BYD, derive more than 2% of their revenue from the Americas, from the U.S. market. That's an extremely important thing to note. equally important, almost $1 trillion in U.S. Treasury, China owns about $1 trillion U.S. Treasury notes, debt. China's foreign reserves is about $3.2 trillion. Of course, there is no known U.S. government holding China's assets. There is no such thing. So, like it or not, China holds all the cards. The Chinese are not dependent on the U.S. at all. They don't need the U.S. Now, a full decoupling. We're talking about the most extreme economic nationalism imaginable. Talking about the severance of all trade, including service trade and technology, intellectual property, whatever. Cleanse supply chains that are dependent on the other side. Liquidate financial holdings. China's going to sell all of its U.S. Treasury and U.S. assets. The U.S. delists Chinese companies on the stock exchange. China might even nationalize U.S. companies in China in return. Expel each other's businesses. It's a severe policy. Only the U.S. is frightened of it. Now, he makes the argument that this is a good thing. Because as of right now, trading with the enemy is very risky for both sides. It's been weaponized beyond belief. Dependency and vulnerability can be exploited when you have one country especially geared up for a showdown. Severing economic ties removes frictions, negating any real further quarrel or unfair trade, one side or the other. Then he says, well, it's good for the Americans. It removes China as the economic boogeyman. Now the world will find out, can the U.S. restore its trade balance and eliminate its trade deficit? The world will find out if the U.S. can reshore its manufacturing. The world will find out if the U.S. can improve its inflation, its standard of living, and also find out if the U.S. can establish alternative supply chains, source critical materials, etc., and reindustrialize. To a great extent, this fireproofs the Chinese economy, reduces risk exposure to U.S. financial assets. No one wants to be a part of the American meltdown here. Chinese companies take over the domestic market share of the U.S. once they exit from China and vice versa. You internationalize Chinese currency in this case. It's a win-win proposition, he says. But that's just it. Whether it be economics or military, the U.S. is not willing to gamble to see who the winner might be. Remember the Western idiot analysts were talking about the collapse of the Chinese economy when its bubble burst. The bubble was not nearly as large as it was in the U.S. You don't have the Jewish factor nearly as much. But what it did is make housing more affordable. Debts are reduced or simply written off. But one of the aspects of this, the U.S., you know, in getting rid of its migrant invaders, if that's even possible right now, this kind of decoupling can permit a revitalization of American society. Should Trump just go total Pinochet? Maybe so. The cultural and civilizational revival. This is already going on in China. It's been going on for quite a while in Russia. This is about confidence. Part of the issue in promoting American goods in a market is to not just undersell locally made goods, that's obvious, but also to destroy the cultural foundations that these goods are based on. To convince everyone to be Western is to be advanced and intelligent. And that's extremely damaging. They do that all over the world. There's entire departments that do this. You know, corporations and these think tanks are dedicated to this. This is what Tavistock does. You mock your, I say, traditional Asian ideas as being backwards, and you talk about foot binding and everything else, you know. So it's not merely a matter of underselling your opponent. You have to destroy its culture first. You know, around the time when China entered the WTO, many Chinese lost contact with a very ancient tradition and culture. They were convinced that the Western-type consumerism was the way to go. Hedonism. Divorces increased. Consumers wanted Western brands, not just, you know, because they were cheaper, maybe, but because they could flaunt it. It's for vanity. Having a Western bag, having a Western outfit, having a Western car. Intellectuals promoting nihilism, which is essentially the same thing as Western liberalism. Advocating these policies blindly, not really understanding what this is going to do. Imperialism is in part based on that. But there has been, and this is why the sanctions against both countries, but Russia especially, have been a gift. As Russia has been able to rediscover itself. She has done the same. Some variant of traditional values within the Han society. Chinese consumers today tend to buy brands from, let's say, sporting goods from FMCG. Chinese companies. Local fast foods, you know, the Western ones are not doing very well, thank God. They want domestic, not necessarily foreign travel, leisure travel, but domestic ones, local ones. That Chinese video games like Black Myth and Wukong are just as, you know, very easily as competitive as anything that the West puts out. And video games, as we know, are a part of this manipulation. Same thing goes for films, period dramas, domestic films, traditional literature. The days of Hollywood blockbusters dominating Chinese box offices are gone. People rediscovering what the hell a Confucian is or what a Taoist is. I don't really know. I'm not sure they know. But they're in a much better position than I am to understand. The century of humiliation is over. It would benefit the U.S. tremendously to simply decouple its empire from China, to shut down these military bases, to really go after the left, to shut down many leftist institutions, to shut down, you know, Antifa and the rest of it. This has been happening with the, you know, and Trump is doing, and what you see what he's facing with the military and the National Guard going into cities. Well, local governments have failed miserably to stop crime. So what other choice do we have? Either you just suffer, or you got to go to the next level. Racial, at least some level of racial and linguistic or ethnic homogeneity may be at least possible. And only on that basis can you have social trust. Only on that basis can you have strong family ties. It doesn't exist with diversity. And when I get to it, I have a long list of sociological studies proving that. These authors are terrified of, you know, they know what it means, but they condemn it enough. We talked about it with the IQ stuff. You know, they condemn it enough where, I don't mean it that way. No. It is conceivable. This may well be the final chapter in the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. The U.S. doesn't have much time left. I think I've been saying about Putin for a long time, but he will earn his place in Chinese history. He is the anti-Mao. He is the last the last stage in erasing the most evil man who ever lived. I don't care if they call themselves communists. They're not. You can't have private sector under communism. You can't have a free, a private press under communism. You can't have private universities under communism. This isn't Stalinist central planning here. And it's not Marxist anymore. They'll use some of the language and stuff, which makes sense for continuity's sake, but that's it, and nothing more. No one can deny their success, and much of their success comes from their racial and ethnic identification. The Han Chinese make up 90%, 95% of their population, which is why the West has done everything it could to create race wars by inventing stories about Western China, whether it be Tibet or the Uyghur nonsense. Possibly even one day, the return of an ancient monarchy. I don't know. But decoupling is necessary for any of this to even be thought of, let alone actually occurring. Thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.